gone.
I don't know, some guys came in and took it away on the
blank. It's a good interface. I saw this one that said blank, and I thought that sounds good. And it made it go dark. I feel loved. Okay, what I want to do is read the names off every paper that I have or have access to. And then if anyone wrote a paper and I don't seem to have it, shout. All right, because I've got to go to Tennessee and that's what I'm going to read everything. All right, Demi. Is it Demi or Demi?
Demi.
Demi? Demi? So you accent your first. You accent the first, yeah. Or equal emphasis.
Wow.
That's actually hard to do. Sean, it is the company's the right post, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And I got your friends and links. I cleaned out everything.
Awesome.
Cool. Aya, yeah. I got yours. Marital. David Nolan. Is David here? Did I see him? Who is MJ?
Oh, right here. I think I put my name on it somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. Ariana? Just pay attention if you're not
called. From Michael Jackson.
David Yates? It's too late. Makiko? With cool pictures. Sean? Who I didn't call yet, right? Did I already call you? All right, so that means I printed you out. And Marie printed out. D. Oh, there's Makiko again. Cool. Let's see if I read it twice. And here's Aya. Rich. Whoa. How does that happen?
It's a special device.
Metalless stapler thing. I want one. You didn't make this thing, did you?
No.
No. Jason Kaufman. Fuyuhiko. Ryan, who's not here. Whoa, thick paper. Benjamin Brown. And cardstock. Kill extra trees. Ariel. The fourth tench. Ariana, who I think I called before.
I emailed you and then I gave you a
pronoun. But they're the same, yeah.
One's much better than
the other. Oh, yeah. Nurit. And Amit. Anyone not called who wrote a paper? Anyone not called who didn't write a paper? All right, cool. Did you guys, I know you guys made your groups. Did you have a chance to actually meet or communicate at all independently? Cool. Because then that's, you know, I was going to say once when I needed to make groups in a class, I did it by putting a schedule up on the board, creating meeting times, and then seeing who could make what time. That's like the hardest thing. So feel free to use whatever social software you need in order to convene. The other thing I wanted to figure out about the projects is, we can discuss this part openly. Are there projects that you're thinking of that you feel would be compromised by discussing them openly in class before they're launched outside? Okay. That being the case, what I still want to do is, depending on how much time there is this week, I want to also allow 15-minute to maybe even 20-minute times in here. I mean, I think it'd be valuable. I hate to take class time away, but it's actually work time, and it's a time that you're all around. So to take 15 or 20 minutes, like the last 15 or 20 minutes of each class, so that you can actually meet, even just logistically, for 20 minutes in here is probably worth it. And then it would give me a chance to be privy to some of what's going on without having the leak, right? Because the one of the big problems with focus groups, and I tried to say this to all these various companies, a lot of companies try to do viral tried to test viral strategies with massive focus groups, in spite of the fact that I tried to tell them that they're creating the exact same situation as like a flu shot. In other words, if you test market a viral campaign, you're basically inoculating, you're giving a microdose of your virus to culture itself before you put it out there. You could actually, it seems to me to be the stupidest thing, that if you're actually going to do a real viral thing, you've got to just do it.
Well, can't the focus group itself be like the initial infection?
It can be, but then you have to realize the focus group is the initial infection. I mean, when it wasn't in the tape, but we taped, and I thought it was better stuff, we taped Frank Luntz doing Israel focus groups. And the way he did his Israel focus groups was he brought in journalism students from all the universities in New York. And he was, because he thought for some reason that that was an interesting group to talk to about various shifts in language that they wanted to use for how Israel is talked about in the American media. So they were testing homicide bomber versus suicide bomber. They were testing wall versus fence for the, whatever that thing is called. Did you do a paper and did I call his name?
No. Where did you call his name?
You called my name and I did a paper.
I don't have it?
Yeah, but I emailed you about it.
That you're doing it. Okay, good. All right. So you're accounted for.
Yeah.
Right. All right. So they were doing all this, and it seemed to me at that point, and I have a feeling Luntz kind of knew it, if you're bringing in journalism students and spending 3 hours with them trying to explain to them why homicide bomber is a more accurate way to say something than suicide bomber, you're not just doing a test. You're actually doing the work. Because they end up talking to, you know, in all those focus groups, 200 or 300 of the people who are editing and writing college newspapers. So it seemed to me disingenuous to call that a focus group at that point. That was actually the beginning of the campaign, you know, because you can't get in the editors of all the newspapers into a focus group, but college ones maybe. So it was weird. It was weird to watch that. All right, so we'll do that. We'll do our viral things, our viral talk. Was there a do for this week? I don't think so. Right? It was just all this
groups.
Right. You're going to meet in your groups. I hear the discussion last week was good. What I want to do to make up for my not being here is schedule, and it doesn't matter to me that it happened this second, or in the next week or two. I want to schedule individual meetings with everybody just to talk about stuff, and that can also be where, if there are outstanding issues with what you wrote, we can talk about them there too. And that to me, you know, even if it ends up just being, you know, 10, 15 minutes a pop, it's just as valuable. I mean, it's more time, it's officially more whatever, time per person, per eyeball, whatever, than a class. So I'm not worried about having gypped you, right? And from all accounts, the discussion last week worked. Were there consensus conclusions, or was there a consensus divide by the end of it? Was there like a central issue that it came down to, as you were talking about sort of ubiquity and living inside this thing? Was there a salient point, an insight, something someone went home with that felt different? There's a lot of Israel in there. And I was there a lot of Israel and neocons, and I was hoping that the discussion wouldn't just... What did we call that page? I forgot what I called the page. What did I call it? I mean, do you remember what I called the page that I put up with the discussion points?
Yeah, nightmares, HTML.
It might not be in the.
I can shut up when you were typing.
Yeah.
The projector's off.
It's okay. You don't need to see it. All right, then I would do. I'll check blank.
How do we know if it's there, though? You can't see it.
You don't. I
what,
can
what
totally cover you
it?
Up.
What is it?
Right. Right, yeah, the thing I got really interested in was and trying to bring it back to that, was sort of the role of technology and all that. You know, that was, what's the difference between King Hosea in ancient Israel, you know, through whatever media they have, creating a state of panic so that people return to, to religion in the face of invaders. What's the difference between that and a Cheney's thermometer that goes on Fox News saying, you know, how much danger we're in at any given moment? You know, is there, if I were going to look sort of biblically for an example of the way technology was used to create fear, there's a lot of talk about the Egyptians and their chariots coming in, because chariots was a technology that the Israelites didn't have. These big metal harvests, like tanks, you know, these otherworldly things coming in and getting them. So then you can say, ooh, they've got, you know, this stuff. Or now with our terrorists turning planes against our civilization and all. But, you know, so that's sort of the way, and nukes and viral technologies and all that is sort of how the subject matter of technology can be used to create the content of nightmares. But it seems that the technology of media can be used to create a nightmarish environment in ways that are substantially different from how, say, just talk can do it. In other words, hearing things on the radio about these horrible people that we've got to go kill may be different than hearing about it from your neighbor or going to the town square and hearing. Are you guys watching Rome at all? It's very interesting, the series, because they have an old sort of calendar they're using, and the media of the day is a fat guy who stands in the middle of town and goes, "And Caesar has conquered the troops!" You know, and you know, "And bread is being brought to you by the local baker's foundry!" And you realize what that was media, right? I mean, it was low tech. But, or was it? You know, is it because he's got this thing he can unroll and read? You know, that no one else there knows how to read except this guy and some nobles. But he's reading this thing, and that gives him, because, you know, the technology of writing. But it seems to me that without that technological leg up, we believe a lot less, that it doesn't really work, that you don't get this the total nightmare. But then on the other side, I look at situations like Salem witch trials and the Crucible. You know, when you see a whole nation, or certainly a whole area, get swept up in a nightmare and basically move into, although people have explained that as ergot growing on the rye or something that made everyone go crazy and start seeing things. It was basically LSD, some form of LSD on the fungus growing on the rye that made them all go nuts. That would also explain, that wouldn't be a technology such, but an environmental factor.
Biotech.
Yeah, but from God, you know, or whatever. Or from the greeny engines of creation, not from, you know, the labs. The Salem lab, Genentech labs, right? Monsanto, I guess it would be.
I thought the ergot was the French Revolution. So.
It's always ergot. And it explains better. They go back and explain pretty much everything that way. So no, one salient thought.
No, the consensus between the class, I mean, Amit did a really good job moderating in a very, like, biased way, but also it was between how did this make you feel initially, and do you feel more or less scared than you did before you saw this? It was sort of like what we ended up talking about. And a lot of people, you know, felt like they were upset. I don't really remember. I think a lot of people said, you know, they they were really upset by this DVD, and then I noticed Aaron Coyote said that he felt really relieved afterwards. I felt kind of the same way, just that, not in a different way than the Century of the Self, just that, like, you are exposed to this idea that there is, you know, another story, another layer to what is being presented to you, and also that this layer is a result of a previous layer, and it's trying to, like, bridge the gap between the two and make sure that the story is consistent.
Mm.
But, like, you can either take it and be upset about it and that it has happened to you, or you can say, like, oh, it's good to know this. Now I can see it in the future. We never really resolved it. It was just kind of like two sides. Some people felt really upset, some people didn't know. So I think it was more, like, really kind of focused on, like, the feeling, especially he showed this, like, Z. Frank Red Alert. And it was the comical side to this.
Right.
And it was very sort of depressurizing in a way. It was very tense for him.
Right.
I think we did two things. We talked first about how we feel about this, just so we can get it out of the way.
Yeah.
Because the facts and the emotions.
That's smart.
Yeah. So regarding the feeling, really some of us felt pressurized, like, now that we know that it's not even an organization, it's actually, in some respects, even worse, because at least if you cut your head off or you cut the middle off an organization, something would happen. But in this sort of, like, Clay Shirky's type of network, it's a problem. But I think we talked about how technology-wise it made more sense to the government to present this idea because it's more manageable, the idea that they're presenting about an organization.
Right.
So as far as how we felt about it, I think that was a problem. But as far as the technology and the facts go, which we discussed afterwards, David mentioned something interesting. I mean, a bunch of us talked about it in different ways, but I remember what he put it, the fact that the technology, the fact that terrorism can happen anywhere at any time, regardless of the central node, and the fact that the media right now is kind of timeless in the sense that you get to proliferate ideas, so there's some sort of balance and something interesting between the two. They're sort of complementary to each other. And maybe that's the power.
Right.
Technology in the sense of what terrorism is.
Right. I mean, that in the one sense it allows for these eruptions, but if it's if it's a truly turbulent, chaotic system, a truly networked system, then there's a certain amount of homeostasis that should begin. In other words, that it can become a self-regulating system and actually end up with more predictability, not less, if you let it happen. I mean, things like, you know, the weather and the ocean and the turning of the planets and all, viewed from certain perspectives, seem completely unpredictable, but when you understand them as waveforms, as big chaotic systems, they're actually quite stable. I mean, when you look at this hurricanes, you go, oh my God, there's all these new hurricanes and all that. When you look in a big time span, you go, oh look, every 30 years there's this sort of shift and this happens and that. In some ways it's actually oddly comforting that it happens that way. Yeah, I wrote, it's funny, it's an interesting bridge between that week and this. I wrote a piece that ended up getting a lot of attention for a very short amount of time. I thought it was going to get me a call from, you know, government types. Because it used to be when I'd write something that I thought was truly insightful about sort of the world, I'd get like a weird call. I got a call like from Newt Gingrich's office. Can you please fly down to Washington to talk to us about this? Wow, because they really had their ears out, you know, or a Clinton thing, or Gore people. I mean, I used to get these, I don't know whether they're just too busy now or what, but I wrote a piece talking about suicide. It was after the England ones, talking about suicide bombs as a viral phenomenon and not a cause and effect phenomenon. That the only way to understand them is not through borders and directions and all that, but as sort of spontaneous eruptions that happen because we're in mass media. I remember people in England were also surprised that it was British nationals who had done this thing, as if it has to be someone who came from somewhere else, being trained in that place, and then infiltrates and does the thing to us. The them has to do it to us. They didn't understand that if you look at it from a viral perspective, you don't, certainly a media viral perspective, you don't need that direct contact from Osamu to Akbar to Joe. You know, it's like you can go through Joe's house and you're not going to find the letter. you know, you're not going to find that link. You know, it turns out Joe watched CNN and thought about this. I wanted to do a long time ago, I wanted to write a short story about like a teenage junior high school girl. The whole story was going to take place in the moment after this girl decides she's a suicide bomber. She goes into the lunchroom, the cafeteria of her junior high school, and pulls the cord, and the whole story was going to happen between the time that she pulled the cord and when she blows up. But what I was trying to show was, you know, how it's just as likely to be some, you know, 14-year-old teenage girl if you're in that Power of Nightmares kind of world, if you're really living inside a world with as many indirect or non-linear sort of media connections happening. So I wrote that piece, and then got all this attention from European smart lefty and intelligence think tank Stratfor. Have you heard of this thing?
Yeah, that's not lefty or European.
What is that?
It's based out of Austin, Texas.
Stratfor Intelligence wanted to talk to me about something. But and Barrett was some girl's name. Jenny's? Mary's?
James.
Yeah.
James.
They were like, oh, this is interesting. But no governments. Although maybe those are the government now. I don't know. I don't know how things work anymore. But the thing I found relieving about Power of Nightmares, looking at it this time, was in a way I found it relieving that it's not big business, that it's not the military-industrial complex. I mean, I always used to think of it as, oh, it's big business and big oil, and these guys are pushing our government to do these nasty things. And it's like, no, it's religious crackpots actually pushing business, if anything. It's sort of,
is that really true, though? Because my impression is the opposite. Like, in the Power of Nightmares, was sort of a side plot. And, you know, they got co-opted by the people in power. They had an explanation. But, you know, Cheney still cares about oil, and Bush still cares about oil.
I think that just goes back to the point about what you were saying about looking at chaotic system too closely. Like, focusing on business.
Right.
Like, how can you predict these things? It's so unfair. When you pull back and say, well, you know, business, religious, and, you know, looking at it as a system, it does tend to make more sense.
They do relate, but the thing that I mean, I just wrote this book on business, where, and I met with a lot of business people, and I have left my 4 or 5 year odyssey through the business world utterly convinced that there's extremely little conscious behavior in business, that it's extraordinarily reactive, and it's based in sort of these legacies from 15th century chartered corporate models, and that they really are, I mean, I might sound more like a fascist now than a communist, but these are problems of stupidity and ignorance, not problems of evil or ill will. That these people running these companies, CEOs even, who are rich, I'm still a child on this level, and I look at someone with a big house and lots of cars and don't understand how, if I'm smarter than them, they have all this stuff. But they're not actually intelligent from the way that we would understand intelligence. They are focused, and they're strategic to a certain extent, but that they do not have an open source relationship to their own businesses. In other words, they don't really understand how their own industries work. The president of the Gap is a Disney executive who, the day that he got the job, said in the press conference, I have no experience in the garment industry, and that's just fine. Right? So he doesn't understand. He understands something else. He understands how to get Sarah Jessica Parker to be in the ad. Right? Which is important on a certain level to business, but it's not... You put him up against H&M or Zara, and he's screwed, right? Because these guys, the guys running those companies, came up in the garment industry, and I still believe that if you understand production and you have, like Zara does, like a 3-week production cycle from the time they see something on a runway to the time they get it in the store window, they get the product in the store window faster than Vogue can get a picture of the runway item in the magazine. So that in Spain, women are going to Zara stores to see fashions, to see what's coming. I mean, that's, I mean, ethics aside, that's good business. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? That's good. They know what they're doing. Where the gap is 18-month turnaround, and they can't adjust their inventories based on what's being bought or not. They don't do just-in-time ordering. Whereas at a place like H&M or Zara, their cash register is looking at what's been bought, and that's sending information back to the factories that are deciding, oh, red's selling really well, and computers are saying, let's make 2,400 more reds and less oranges today. And then they get them into the store. I mean, God, that's... If you're going to be the Gap, though, if that's what your business is, which is copying fashion and getting it on there and making it cheaper, that's what they should be doing, not the crap they're doing. Because after a certain amount of time, people are going to realize I'm getting what I want here and not there. Which is a long way of saying, though, I don't think that these people, if they don't even understand their businesses, and they don't understand economics, they don't. You talk to them about interest rates and how it affects things, and they don't understand inflation. They don't understand.
People do that for them, though.
Yeah, but those people don't really get it either. I mean, I talked to the chief strategist at Lehman about this stuff, and he goes, "Well, you know, you'd have to really talk to an economist about that. We don't really know. I mean, what do? They if the stock went down, they put in a sell recommendation on it. The stock goes up, they put a buy recommendation, which means what you should do if you're actually into the stocks is do the opposite of what they're saying, right? Because they're reactive. They're all scared and reactive and strained, which is actually...
Did you say it's strained or
and strange? And strange. And strange. Estranged might be better. They're alienated from what they actually do, which is why they're so easily... because it's a system, as you're saying, almost anyone who's conscious in that system ends up having tremendous leverage if they know how to use it, because everybody else is moving blindly. If everybody else are just sort of these iron filings moving back and forth, all you have to do is figure out where to put the magnet and you get people going. So religion's really powerful in that.
It all depends on the industries and stuff too, though, because I mean, there are some CEOs that do actually know the business and drive it. Like the thing with that whole supply chain isn't really the company or the garment industry, it's really somebody like Oracle that sold them the solution. And does Larry Ellison, the CEO of Oracle, actually know that system? Yeah, he does. He probably laid all out in order of how it actually functions and works and kind of developed it. But the fashion industry is a different thing. It's a reactive thing to trend. And then the other...
It's reactive now.
Yeah, but the thing is, the great thing about someone like Zara is he realizes he is not making fashion, he's reacting to fashion. So he gets out of the way. He's like, we are not, you know, he doesn't need designers as such, he needs copiers. And he realizes that, you know, that's really all I'm saying is in whatever business you're in, is understanding what you actually do. I mean, like, you look at what happened to Shell Oil and how far off course they went. They forgot how to refine, they forgot how to explore, they forgot how to do everything because they were thinking about GBN scenario planning and marketing themselves. But yeah, there are CEOs who understand what they do. I mean, and who understand what other company they need to go to get it. You know, like a Richard Branson or someone. He's it's not just a Midas touch. He understands what he's selling. It's a certain, he's selling an aura, really. You know, and he can find an industry and figure out how to put that aura on it. But to power a nightmare, is it just this, my nightmare was always, when I get in my paranoid delusions, it's always these sort of captains of industry, these oil titans who are, you know, would rather us all die and stay addicted to oil rather than help us create, you know, renewable energy resources. And most of these guys don't really have time or energy or capacity to think about how are we going to shift from oil to such and such, although BP is at least pretending to try.
But they don't have time, capacity, or courage, because it's like, if you suggest that the machine stop running in a certain way, then, you know, there's all the budget and the dependencies and the people.
But
the
that's
jobs.
Because I would argue that they are in the same nightmare as everybody else. And the ones who are powerful, if we are in a nightmare, the ones who are powerful are people who believe they have access, and this is why I'm a storyteller, people who believe they have access to the mythology itself, to the to the nightmare, to the nightmare's creation and proliferation. And that's why, to me, the neocons became interesting as religious myth purveyors of myth, because it was like, well, at least they do have certain power because they're telling stories.
But are the powerful people the ones that have access to the mythology? Because you're saying because they can nuance it, right? But is it them, or is it really in a system of kind of like you said, chaotic little iron filings? It seems more like the power is in whoever can spread an idea, any idea, quick enough.
Right.
So it's just like the mass moves the mass, not even the power of the message, more so that the message itself. It could be a dumb one, but if it's
right.
If it's
well, big, and that brings us directly to the main problem I had in writing Media Virus, and the question I left unanswered, is that there seemed to be, I presented there being two kinds of media viruses, sort of intentional media viruses that are crafted by people to go places, and then spontaneous media viruses. So the Rodney King media virus is the spontaneous event that ends up, because there's enough camcorders around, being captured. It spreads because its shell is a story about media. It spreads to the media. It replicates and remains alive because the internal code nests itself in our own incomplete code about race relations and police and LA and all that, and goes. And then there's intentional media viruses like Calvin Klein photographing children in their underwear, which he knows he's going to have to take off the air, and he only puts on because he wants to get to take it off the air, or his people, and then get all that secondary media about it. Now, the question is whether intentional media viruses, are they created, or are they just, I mean, they are. Finally, that was something that was created, but it's really doing is provoking an existing immune deficiency, at least in the model that I'm using, that the culture has these gaps. In other words, child porn is one of our gaps. It's something we haven't dealt with. It's the thing that got me almost kicked off. I told you the story, right? My Frontline documentary, because I was like, well, who says child porn? Who says, you know, that children shouldn't see porn? Which is too dangerous to say. But still, find me the study that says children... You're not allowed to do that study because it's illegal, right? Because... Ba-dum-bum, so we're stuck. I mean, that's a perfect power of nightmare sort of situation, right? The enemy is there and we can't talk about it because the enemy is there. Any of those catch-22s bother me. But if you call to mind, if you call attention to any catch-22 like that, you're called a Marxist. Oddly enough. And I don't know that that's...
So the real person, the real power, you're saying, lies in the person that has the people that have access to the mythology, but also can see the gaps in...
Well,
see where
I don't know.
Needs to happen.
You know, I don't know. You see, power is another thing. And power is the interesting part to look at. Did Calvin Klein's ability, or Calvin Klein's advertising people's ability to... nest themselves on that virus, give them more power or not? In other words, if the memes of the virus are really married to the shell of the virus in such a way as to be basically inseparable, so that I don't know. I mean, Calvin Klein, he sure sold a lot of underwear, right? I mean, Calvin Klein came on the scene when I was a little kid with Brooke Shields as like a 14-year-old model saying, "Nothing gets between me and my Calvins," which I guess was suggesting two things. One, that she wasn't wearing underwear, and two, that, I don't know, that you can't get your sex organ into her or something? I don't know. Something like that. You can't put your hand... I don't know what... You know what I mean? There's some sexual innuendo in there. I was too young to understand, and I'm too old to understand now. But there was something sexual about that, the pretty baby girl, you know, making this... some kind of entendre ad that I don't understand. And it was in keeping with their image to do first those ads that look like pornography auditions where kids were sitting on a carpet in some kind of like a suburban basement answering weird questions.
The androgyny adds to everybody. You want to show what you, who you're looking at.
Right.
Super close up, like smooth skin.
Right. Yeah. Am I allowed to be turned down by this or not? Right. But it's all different parts of Kate Moss, right? On drugs. She lost her H&M account because of it. Mothers don't do coke. Forget it. It's a media
or
story.
Or H&M gets themselves in the headline by dumping her. Like,
yeah, I don't think they wanted that one. If anything, they got themselves in the headlines for being good.
Right.
No, but I think that was one of the reasons why more and more, like, H&M were the first people like, oh, this is bad, and that was a headline, H&M, dump Kate Moss, blah, blah, blah. And then the other people who had previously been like, oh, we don't really give a shit, were like, but if we say we give a shit, then we'll get in the headlines. It's ridiculous.
Right, there's no big stories about the people who she still works for, who she wrote where her contract still works.
Yeah. Right. That'll be her on the cover the next month.
I mean, she has contracts still, right? She's still working.
She's on the dole.
Okay, good. I was worried for her. I mean,
all the people who like doesn't post H&M's name, then we'll take her back out again as well.
Yeah.
She's on a food stamp.
She does, 3 days of rehab.
Just one.
And she's fine. I mean, there is. There's definitely communicative power in successful viral stuff. I mean, the thing that, and the reason why I wanted you to read some of those other people like Gladwell and Seth Godin on viruses is, I think most of these people still misunderstand what a media virus is and how it works. In other words, they'll talk about sort of general trends in contagious ideas. Yeah?
Well, I was going to say, I think that the argument with Leto, I saw him down at the Strand a couple weeks ago, and he explained that his writing method is he presents an argument, but he doesn't fully reinforce it. He just kind of leaves it open-ended, so he says. But then by doing that, you can't really, like, hammer down, this is, these are the characteristics of, say, like, a media virus or a tipping point, that you're trying to get across. It's, I don't know.
He basically admits he's saying nothing. Yeah.
He's not really standing for anything. He's just kind
right.
of, oh, here's this thing. And,
yeah, but I look down on that kind of. I'm just a journalist. I'm just sort of reporting what's happening. And I kind of look down on that because.
He's picking specific stories as well that reinforce maybe just some particular idea. I didn't notice that he really put out a lot of counterpoints. Just kind of like, there's an event that occurred.
Yeah. I mean, most journalists who write about media, and especially about marketing and thought contagion and ideas and all that, end up having to take a stand end up having to be identified somewhere on the right-left divide. In other words, are you pro-market or anti-market? Are you saying that these techniques are ethical to use or not ethical to use? I remember after I did the tour for Media Virus, everyone was asking me, are you saying media viruses are a good thing or a bad thing? And I always used to say, well, they're a thing, when the cheetah jumps on the gazelle, is it a good thing or a bad thing? It's good for the cheetah, bad for the gazelle. It's like, where do you... And then I realized, over time, that I don't think that that's... I don't think it's finally a responsible position to take. I think on a certain level it's more appropriate to look at what's the impact of the things I'm saying? What are the implications of what I'm saying or what I'm revealing, and what are the ways I think that this information could be used to make our world a better place, and what are the ways I think this information could be used that would make our world a nastier place? There is a certain responsibility that you can't just say, I'm just the messenger.
Well, particularly if you're Malcolm Gladwell and you're saying that everything that goes into a system changes it. I'm just the messenger, but my message is going
right,
to
but the reason he does that, and this is between us, the reason he doesn't, a lot of these people do that, is because they're peddling their wares to marketers. You know, that's what they do. They get $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 to go to... She had a little bump. She had a little thing there. To give Exxon this stuff instead of the local library or whatever. No, and that's why, I mean, in the end, that's why I wrote a business book. It's like, well, fine. If you guys are going to read every one of my books, then I'm going to write a book for you. It says, you know, what I think you do and how it should work and da-da-da. You know, we'll see if it works. It's basically trying to say, take an open source approach towards your corporate charters. Realize that that the human beings are in charge of the corporation, okay. Not the corporation in charge of the people. What would that be like?
It's going to be banned from the employee reading list.
No. It won't. Because I'm convincing them, and this is where the Svengali stuff happens, I'm convincing them that they'll make more money doing it this way. You know, they'll actually be more profitable and have more fun. And
but you write a book like that.
Why?
Yeah, to make more money or to make them do what you want them to do.
What's the difference?
No, they could be doing what you want
them to do. What I want them to do is to give me money. did I write it because I have a baby? No. I did it because I'm actually selling the same idea, and when I use the word selling, I'm promoting the same idea in every community I hit, which is that we are writing the story. And I promoted that to the people who I thought came up with that idea, which was Judaism, and they rejected that, you know, pretty hard, because the story is in a weird place right now for Jews and Israel and that whole thing. And it occurred to me that business people might actually be willing to hear that, because there's a certain generic quality about business, and they want to innovate. They want to hear. Their program is so set that if you basically say this is the way your program could work and be more profitable, they're actually going to be more open-minded to it than people that are adhering to a story consciously. And I think that industry is industry and business is a tremendous force right now. I think it's a tremendous force, and I think I think it can be
little help.
It can be tweaked.
All of our conversations on this other stuff always deviate down, or like move on to like economics and stuff like that anyways, or business and all the other parts we're talking about. We're talking about like the marketing and in this, you know, this kind of like, you know, social proliferation of ideas. And we always come down to a discussion like in every one of our classes of sort of like the money trail on something or how one of that's happening. I don't see how you could not want to explore the economic and business end.
Got to go down it at least. I mean, and what I've been looking at for a while is why do people believe in stuff? That's what I used to say from the very beginning, since the early 90s. That what interests me is why people actually believe something. You know, and the belief in money is very interesting. You know, and the underlying qualities of money, the way it is now, how money is created, who creates it, and why. And all that is very interesting, and alternative currency schemes, although they're not working great yet, are very. It's just very interesting. I'm an open source guy, and I'm interested in where are the things, what are the things that are not open source in our civilization, and why, you know? And religions are not open source. Why? Most of them aren't. Some of them were started that way, but they're not. You know, they're closed source. What do we hold to be sacred? Money is closed source, right? I mean, that's the ultimate closed source thing in America right now. You're not allowed to just make it.
When you say open source, you just mean that the participants in the system write the system, design the system, share information to direct the system?
That, I mean, it's funny, I came up with three, there's a blog.
Even with open source, though, don't you see that there's one group that really I mean, it's, you know, like, for instance, Firefox is open source.
Wait, I don't mean open source in the software development. I'm using the term more as a kind of an underlying philosophy that, to me, what open source means in a more philosophical way or cultural way is that is understanding that the codes by which we live were written by people. In other words, that they're not pre-existing conditions. That these codes are... can be understood, and these codes can be rewritten by other people.
How involved in religion, though? be adaptive. It's like, oh, you know, let's throw this in, or I'll, you know, change the idea here.
Well, sort of.
But
it's been like, it's always been like capable. It's just that things change so slowly, it's not going to, you know, things change like somewhere in the middle of your lifetime and then you die. In 100 years, something changes. And we even, I mean, even people
right.
dying now that are born at the turn of the century, and they saw massive changes in civilization.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm talking about things that we take for granted as being pre-existing conditions, like money.
What
if you
Calvin.
Oh,
Calvin and Hobbes. In the comic strip, he had a game called Calvin Ball where they just made the rules up as they went along.
But the thing is, we are making the rules up as we go along to a large extent. We're maybe not making up gravity. Right, there probably are pre-existing conditions to the physical reality, and people die, and people breathe, and babies are born. There's a lot of stuff that is hardware, right? But there's a hell of a lot of stuff that is software that we think of as hardware. Like, most people think money just is, you know, and that this is the way money works, period. They don't know that the way we use money now was in part invented during the Renaissance, you know, with the outlawing of local currencies and the creation of centralized national currencies. People in Italy don't understand that Italy is Italy. You know, they don't think of it. That lineup, they think Italy is just Italy, right? They don't realize that they took, like, Tuscany and Sicily and these places, and someone said one day, this is now Italy, and you're now an Italian. There's a lot of things like that, and there's a lot of great stories. Like, for me, the Torah, the Bible, Old Testament, is so much about that. It's like these people leave this story in Egypt, and they sit down in the desert and they write laws, and they decide, okay, this is the way society can work. You know, it's kind of a pre-revolutionary philosophy, but the idea that we are writing the system. Declaration of Independence and the Enlightenment were terrific for that. That's what they were trying to say, is, oh, we can go to this place and we can create a document that remains open source and that remains evolving, and then we can amend and change based on what we learn in the future. You know, that was a cool thing. You know, some people look at it the other way. Well, the Declaration or the Constitution is something that remains unchanged, and that should be set in stone, and that God had some hand in developing with Jefferson. You know, or whatever. But, you know, oh, that's all. So when I'm talking about...
Well, there are people out there that do recognize the fact that, you know, money's not like a hardened law here. They create their own currency, but it hasn't picked up. So maybe what you should be
right.
asking is, why hasn't it picked up? Why am I
right.
not willing to accept somebody's piece of art as a form of payment versus, you know...
Right, and I would argue that, and this is getting off the track too, I would argue it's habit and belief. And that the more I can provoke people to reconsider. So let me look at the grid pattern of New York. Oh, you mean there were guys that at one time said, let's make a grid pattern in Manhattan. And that's why we have a grid pattern. And a grid pattern leads to certain kinds of behaviors and certain kinds of cultural activity that you wouldn't get if you designed it in a round pattern, like, say, Amsterdam instead of New York. And then you go and say, oh, there are these people like Jane Jacobs that have been writing about things like that, you know, for 100 years. You just, all I try to do in my work is help people see that there are recipes that are being used that people came up with. And I'm very interested in cases where recipes become so set in stone that people don't realize that these are recipes. That people start to think this is just the way things are. I mean, like most people in advertising have a real hard time getting their heads around the idea that commercials have only existed, TV commercials have only existed for like 60 years or something. That this might be a temporary form, that there might be forms of advertising that go on after the commercial. There might be forms of promotion that go on after advertising. You know, and just how deep are you willing to go? And what I'm trying to do in the book is say, the deeper you're willing to go into actually looking at the core processes that define what you do, and the more willing you are to actually reinvent them from the expertise, the more likely you are to be really successful at it. In other words, be fearless about your own expertise and do that, rather than just keep repackaging things or renaming them or finding new ways to market them. And that, I think, could be an attractive idea to business people. But if they do that, and this is where it starts to get more ethical or spiritual. I think if they do that and they're trying to have a genuinely good time as they do that,
it's going to become less about the quarterly report and less about that sort of rapacious venture capital stuff and more about getting into the thing they're doing. And you end up with companies more like, you know, Patagonia, where people are into, you know, well, if we want to have, you know, good microthermal this, then we've got to also have great places for people to go where they can do it so we can't ruin the environment.
I keep thinking about BP and when they change from British Petroleum to BP. They're actually like the largest oil and energy company. And I saw Margaret, whose name I can't, last name I can't remember, but she's the creative director that worked for Landor that helped them reposition BP. And she talked a lot about how they came up with these core values that were going to be part of the BP brand. And one of them was to be a green company. And that the CEO of the company or whatever, you know, he strongly believed this and it came from the top down. And that in all the employee meetings, employee reviews, that they were going to go over their brand attributes, including green, and ask their employees how they had contributed to this green initiative.
So it's true, it's not just bullshit.
No, it's true. The interesting thing about what happened to BP, I mean, the case studies in this book, is when they did that, their stock plummeted because the shareholders were like, what the fuck? We don't want to, this is going to cost money, and renewable energy is not going to be around for the longest time. It's going to ruin our competitive advantage. So he had to actually back off the Beyond Petroleum publicity for a while. Then when he did that, all the green companies, or not green companies, the green organization said, oh, BP, it's all bullshit. This is just greenwashing. This isn't real. And it was finally, it was the employees who had gotten so on the bandwagon of being Beyond Petroleum, the employees then forced management to stay true to what they had set out. And they are. I mean, and they came back then with that campaign of sort of snarky, well, it's a start. You know, they say, oh, we use, you know, 3% less oil and the such and such. And they go, well, it's a start. Which is better. I mean, they're trying to say it's better than nothing. But no, they are genuinely committed to trying to change... trying to change course. And it's, if nothing else, even Amanda Griscombe, who's the little sister of the guy that does NERV, Rufus Griscombe, she's a staunch environmentalist and alternative energy journalist, and she's like, if nothing else, by taking this conversation out into the public, BP is now calling, is making itself accountable in a way that's really scary and dangerous for a company. You know, we'll see if they can achieve anything by doing it, but that's kind of new. GE, a classic polluter. I mean, these are the guys that ruined the Hudson up where I used to have my country house before I had a baby and couldn't afford it anymore. They ruined the Hudson up there, right? And they fought for years not to clean it up so it would get so covered with silt that then they wouldn't have to anymore because it would be so deep that it would cause more pollution to dig it up than to leave it alone. They're the ones who are writing open letters to Bush about energy policy and not signing the Kyoto Accord and all that in the New York Times. So sometimes corporations can flip. Of course, they also are the biggest investor in the world in wind power right now, so it's to their advantage to try to...
Yeah, I think that's more like complaints of the power of nightmares, which I mentioned last week, is that it totally ignores the idea of lobbyists and where all the money's being at. I mean, it's one thing they have an ideology, but, you know, just with the examples of these companies, it's not that... that alone that drives, you know, leadership and where these kind of myths come from.
Exactly. Which is why one of the myths that the left has to deal with, and this is what I just wrote my Arthur column for next month, is that corporations are necessarily and invariably evil. You know, they don't have to be. Corporations are still codable. It's like saying computer programs are evil, which we could say, but we shouldn't. I mean, they can be recoded. Yeah, a corporation that's going to work as a 15th century chartered British company to go take over China with opium, you know, and that's the only rules they know, the only game plan they have, they're going to have to behave in an evil fashion because that's what they were engineered to do. But if people realize that they run the corporations, a lot of things can flip. But back to viral media. Did you guys get, or maybe I should even review it, we have a board. Did you get what media viruses are? Have any questions about this or even challenges about it? I want to make sure we've got, and now the black one isn't working. Blank. I was so happy. Power. Fine. Feedback. Fucking A. Did any of you read that thing on MediaVirus and feel like you recognized this form as something that's real and out there? Or did it feel like, oh, this is some weird new, strange, ugh?
I was reminded of the Dark Knight
Rises
article originally, so I was like, okay, flashback.
Oh, you mean back from the... When the idea came out, when MediaVirus came out, back when... it was this weird new thing that kind of put me on the map. And they threw it in this thing called New Perspectives Quarterly, which I don't know if that's around anymore, but it was a smart person's journal. It's like, okay, here's a guy. I mean, all... It's actually a neurolinguistic programming trick where you take two terms that haven't been brought together and bring them together, media and virus, and it makes people go, what, am I going to catch this thing by watching TV? You know, and it actually, that's how it nests. So MediaVirus ends up becoming a MediaVirus of its own. But the important thing to get, and I wanted a picture in the book and they wouldn't let me have it. The other thing that was funny about MediaVirus is I was saying we should try to sell this on Amazon and all that. And this was in the mid-90s. And I got a letter from the head of publicity at Ballantine Books, big publisher, saying, what is Amazon? Is it for the Mac or the PC? And I saved that letter. You know, it's on the Mac or the PC. So, you know, like, biologically, there'd be, like, this little thing. They draw them like that sometimes. Right? This is the virus. And it's got a shell, and it's got little genetic code inside. So, you know, viruses, even though they make you really sick, they're not living things. They're just, like, little spaceships with genetic code inside. Not that we're living things, either, because we don't know what alive is yet. These things... or a protein shell with code inside. The protein shell is really sticky and sticks on to your cell. Your body doesn't recognize it, at least not yet. That's because you don't have an immune response to it. Your body doesn't recognize that this protein shell is other than happy proteins that are normally floating around in the body. So it lets it on there. The virus then injects these little goobers into you that find their way into the nucleus and then nest themselves on your own DNA. They find little pockets and places in your own code, and then when your cell replicates, it makes more viruses, right? And releases them all over, and you get all sick. Right, so there are these two things going on in a real virus. One is the shell, and the other is the code inside. So what I was trying to do with MediaVirus was look at phenomena like OJ and Rodney and all the stuff that was going on in the early 90s, and argue that the media had taken a different shape. That instead of the good old William Randolph Hearst days, when guys on the top of a glass building come up with an idea and put it on the headlines and disseminate out, that things had gotten so complex. You know, if this was your office building and your guy was up there just dropping the newspaper down, that now, because of fax machines and telephones and Xerox machines, that there was much more of that stuff going on, and that there was so much turbulence in the media system that it was now taking on the qualities of a life form. And I was posing that we have to look at the media space as a chaotic system. Chaos was still really new. In pop cultural talk, systems theory and all that was a very Santa Fe thing. It wasn't talked about. You know, Stephen hadn't written Emergence yet. People weren't thinking bottom up. So the idea was that, oh, there's this other way things can work, this sort of systemic way. And if our media is working systemically, then ideas might travel around more the way they travel around biologically. And biologically, there's two ways for our information to pass around, right? Fucking and contamination, right? And the viral model seemed to me much more appropriate to a media space. The fucking model is great for a word of mouth thing,
In other words, oh, the priest just said this to me. Oh, what did he say to you? You know, you play sort of telephone tag, person to person. You need that one-to-one exchange. But in a media space, you can now have this sort of viral contagion happen through all the wires that are connecting us in all these other different ways. So in a media virus, and this is what dear Seth Godin and the people who've made so much money off these ideas, because they call it viral marketing, what they don't get, and I think it's so important, at least if we're going to be theorists, that we do get, is that there are these two parts to a media virus. There's the protein shell, which is the conduit, which is the real reason why these stories spread. I would argue the O.J. Simpson thing happened. Were you guys alive for that? Yeah. The O.J. Simpson thing happened because media was being used in a different way. We had never seen on TV this slow motion chase. It was like it took long enough that people could call you and say, do you see what's going on? And you look, if you lived in LA, which I did at the time, what happened was people would look outside and see the O.J. thing going, and they go, that's coming to my neighborhood. They'd walk outside the house and get on TV. They'd go to the edge of the highway and they'd walk onto their own screens. It was fine. A lot of people kept talking about it. So that was because of the new way media was used. It launched the O.J. Simpson trial in a way that it wouldn't have launched otherwise. It wasn't just, you know, what is it in American terms? Scary black football player man kills blonde, beautiful woman. You know, that is this stuff. You know, sports hero and all that, you know, all the great American dark, dark racist shit gets to be played out.
That's the meme.
Those are the memes. Oh, you can take the, you know, the, what is it,
the black guy out of the ghetto,
but you can't get the ghetto out of the black guy, right? You can give him a Heisman, but he's still an Ooga Booga. Sorry, but that's you know what I'm saying. That's the and from the other side, it's they'll never let a black guy actually be successful. They'll never let a black guy actually fuck the blonde cheerleader. They're still gonna lynch the black guy for doing it. Right? Because these are two unresolved, unspoken about things.
And that's why the verdict was so crazy, because, you know, everybody's like, wow, this guy killed this woman, but at the same time, the black guy got off the way the white guys get off, which is he had a lot of money, and
right.
He got off. So it was kind of like, everybody could defeat the corrupt system, but that's...
As long as they're rich.
You know?
And then, if you want to play, this is where I always get into this sort of fractal quality and self-similarity, you actually, at the center of the O.J. Simpson virus, you end up with DNA. You know, which was, in the end, it was the crucial evidence, and the DNA was corrupted, and the DNA evidence wasn't being used properly, so you end up with sort of viruses inside viruses, screens inside screens inside screens. It does not fit.
That's why you attribute advertising to you're not trying to do viral marketing, and you're not being successful. At least I see that a lot now, like on websites, these sites that like they're trying to really...
Right, but
redo exactly this.
People that are trying to do this are unsuccessful for two reasons. One, they don't know how to make a shell, and two, their memes suck. Right? Three, they don't understand that they need to make a shell and have memes. They think that viral media is, oh, we'll get a pretty girl to pass out new Camel Reds in bars, and that's our viral campaign. What is the viral campaign? Titties and... Red Camel and bar makes, that's not a viral campaign. Even getting, what's her name? Hilton.
Paris Hilton.
April and Paris Hilton. That's the way the bad brain works. It'll happen to you too. Paris Hilton eating a Hardee's thing while she washes a car, which is sort of like the scene from Dukes of Hazzard where, not Brittany, Murphy,
Jessica
Simpson, not related to O.J., right? She doesn't need a hammer, she just washes a car while she sings the Nancy Sinatra song, right?
Yeah.
That's her thing.
With Willie Nelson!
I don't even understand that. I can't even go there. It's beyond my fucking capacity. But having a blonde girl eat a burger while washing a car is not a viral campaign. even if you create it as a form of media that can be passed by people on their email. In other words, the email attachment is a great conduit for viral media, but only when email attachment is kind of this new...
So it's missing the name? Or it's,
well, kind of missing both.
And it has a faulty protein shell? Or
what is it?
Well, I almost think that the meme would suck because you know where it's coming from.
Well, you sure, you exactly know where it's going, and it's not testing any boundary. I mean, and it kind of has to test, for the viral shell to work, it has to be an unrecognized form of media. It has to actually be the camcorder tape with the black guy getting beaten is like, that gets spread because media's been used in a new way. Media spreads things. This is all just my theory shit, right? This is not necessarily real. I think it's real. Media spreads media. Media is in love with itself. Media is trying to grow. So media, the stories that will spread best in media are stories about media,
but
right?
According to your definition, then there would be very few media viruses that would be possible, right?
At any one time, yeah, but they still happen, right? They still happen.
Well, like, I think maybe that a media virus can be unique, a unique media virus once, and then it has to change.
It's like a strain of
right.
a particular virus. So it's like the virus is the meta category,
yeah.
but there were other maybe videotape things.
Right.
Like
exactly. So right. So then viruses with this kind of protein but different memes
yeah.
inside can still work for a while until we just get sick of the shell.
Yeah.
I mean, eventually, you know, the camcorder tape of blah, blah, blah. So there's another camcorder tape. I mean, cops kind of help this grow immune to the camcorder tape of people getting hit by cops.
But what about, like, Paris Hilton's porno video or something?
Porn is interesting, right? Sex. I mean, sex, when sex is in the meme pool, real sex, it really helps that thing spread, doesn't it? Because those are such unresolved... I mean, in America anyway, sex is our big unresolved thing. People are actually, you know, doing it more or better or whatever. That wouldn't happen so much. I mean, sex sells, right?
Well, but that's why the Marlboro people want the pretty girl in the bar to be hanging out there, or the Camel people want the pretty girl in the bar to be hanging out there.
That's different than Paris Hilton.
Yeah. But what's it called when you get a person to use something once? It's called
endorsement.
No, to get the person to try it, like a trial. Like the girl is there
sample.
To get someone to
like
use.
Free sample.
Well, it's to use. It's called. There's a word for it.
Pushing.
No, there's a barrier. There's always a barrier to entry to sampling something. So you're trying to get someone. So you give free samples in order to get someone to actually use a product once.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of a gateway thing, but there's a word for to trial something or to
induction.
No, it's just a Madison Avenue kind of term for when you get people to sample the thing. I mean, how do you do that? So in a bar with cigarettes and pretty girl, oh, come on, smoke one. They smoke one, so then when they've actually, in theory, if you get the person to then like it, then at least they go on. They don't keep smoking it because the pretty girl gave it to them, but they do it that once because the girl gave it to them.
And because of the rules of engagement, just the idea of once you start something, same reason why people send gifts or why you have to hand something back. As long as you start some kind of communication, people are more likely to continue it than to. It's harder to stop.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, the conversation is begun. Once you've accepted a product from a company or a person, then there's some sense of obligation. But you get in trouble that way. But to hear the Sunlight story, Sunlight's this dishwashing detergent with a big picture of a lemon on it, and they gave out free samples in Los Angeles, and Spanish people who couldn't read it thought it was lemon juice and put it in their tea.
Oh my God.
Oh,
I don't know. They bought more of it than the hand-washing people. But most of the examples of what they're trying to call viral media is not really. I mean, there's things that kind of border on it that they're kind of interesting, like the Burger King chicken
You guys remember that?
Submersive chicken?
Yeah, and you type things. I mean, that was a little interesting because it was a new... It was a new use of the internet, right? So the reason it got attention was because here's a new media thing, and the media picked it up, which is the spread, right? The spread is not just person to person. The spread is that it gets what's called secondary media. So all the news shows, everyone loves it. We've got something to put on the evening news, right? Which is this chicken thing. And people who make the evening news and the evening news itself, that for a conscious entity, is most interested in media. It's most interested in itself, as in any system. That's the way, you know, systems are.
What prevents something like that, or like the Jim Jam advertising, or, you know, that cartoon during the political campaigns? What makes that not a viral?
I don't remember the cartoon.
Jim Jam? You guys know what I'm talking
this
about?
This land is your land, this land is my land. Oh. Bush and
they got a lot of popularity.
That was interesting. That might have been a breakthrough flash. I mean, for me, it wasn't.
That's kind of dumb.
Yeah.
That's
but it did work.
The funny thing is that it was sent around so much to the point that the news media then picked it up from there.
Right.
Yeah.
They're usually, I almost count them as being slow as well.
Yeah.
Internet.
I mean, Swiftboat blogging was, I would argue, that ended up being a media virus, because blogs, as far as the American mainstream consciousness were concerned, blogs did not exist. So this watershed moment for the blog, when everyone goes, oh, blog, 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 was had Swiftboat memes in it, really. I think that's most Americans' first exposure to the blog. Most newscasts first talking about blogs were either that or the sort of the blogs at their conventions. People were sort of thinking about that, but then it was those. I mean, and now we're kind of, interestingly enough, I think people are kind of immune to blogs. I mean, not that we shouldn't still do them, of course, but.
But what about ones that don't make it to those other levels of media, then, for example? Because, I mean, the interesting thing is just the time point that we're in right now and the transition of, okay, well, if everything's being passed back and forth through interactive media, and that's really just the new carrier for all this. But then we mark it as like this success or moment when it goes, percolates back up into the mass media channel and is like validated. Like, oh, it's validated because,
right,
you know, it wound up here. But in the shift in the way that we're going, they won't wind up there. That's irrelevant.
That is interesting.
And now it's a validation.
Right. I mean, like, you know, Al Gore's TV thing was originally going to be an internet thing. And then he decided TV is still the dominant medium, and he didn't want to be not on TV. So he sacrificed some great portion of the initial vision to do a TV show or a TV channel. I mean, systemically, I think we still live in a mainstream society, you know, in kind of a broadcast world, and it for the kind of, it's interesting. I mean, there are examples of things happening without mainstream media where the uptake still works. Like, you know, the SMS in Spain after the bombing, where people found out that the government was kind of lying about who did it, and it changed, ended up changing the way the election would have been. Or Tiananmen Square was a largely fax and emailed thing. I mean, that happens, but it's sort of, if it doesn't get that mainstream media endorsement, even almost against the mainstream media's will, it doesn't quite feel the same. It's like when you can get the machine itself working against what seems like its own interests, that's when it's fun. When Mike Judge can get Beavis and Butthead through Liquid Television onto MTV and have it be so popular that it deconstructs MTV videos and leads to MTV no longer showing rock videos, that's interesting. You know, when the virus can infect the sort of corporate conglomerate media thing, you know.
But is it? I mean, you said that like whenever you were doing the tour with this book a long time ago, you're like, well, they just are. But now, I mean, is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? I mean, if presumably it's a thing that is part of something that people made. So are media viruses useful, or are they dangerous, or do they, I mean, it seems to me, and this is obviously just my reaction to it, that they contribute a lot to the circumstances that allow the kind of nightmare vision to be there. I don't think they ameliorate that. I think they make it worse. So my contention is they're not a good thing, and that it's useful to understand them, but propagating them is probably not really very helpful.
Was InfoWars the video we were supposed to watch for this week?
Yeah.
I mean, I think InfoWars has some good examples of the counter-argument.
Sure, but I just missed
it. Yeah, the interesting thing, though, I mean, just so many ways to look at that. One is, in terms of it making the media space more of a war zone, even, I agree with you. So now we've got, you know, these people launching their viruses, and these one launching their viruses, and, you know, it's even if you're Artmark and eToy and groups I like, say, it's still an extremely combative, militaristic model they're using, even as a prankster, to infiltrate and break the thing, so then they're going to try to protect them, boom, boom. I mean, so in the one sense, it makes the terrain feel more militaristic. On the and in the other hand, while as a young person writing a book in a media space that felt controlled by Rupert Murdoch, I felt like any access that now the little people have to the media space is a good thing.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know,
but now that viral media is, I mean, when everything that I hear about this is not, you know, there's things like eToy, and I've seen very useful uses of those things, but mostly the media viruses that seem to get passed are not even proper. They're things that have been deliberately made up to sell things to people, like pass on. Mm. And people send them to me. Like, are you retarded? I don't want a video that by BMW cars. Like,
right, but then is this, but then what is the, rather than looking at is it a good thing or a bad thing, what is the most appropriate response us and of education to that?
But I do think the one dangerous thing in it that it kind of exists, well, it sort of does. I mean, I'm not entirely certain that some of the things we're talking about are media viruses, but that the thing that you're talking about and the way that you're describing it means that it has to be new all the time, and that in that way, because people get immune to the viruses so quickly, so in that way, constant media viruses contribute to a media space that's constantly changing, that's confusing to people, and that allows them to be blindsided
by
things.
Right, but should something be confusing and frightening just because it's changing? In other words, if you take the point of view of, say, a cultural model, we live in a culture which is a living, mutating, changing, vibrant, fertile place that, for my model for right now, evil, horrible business people and religious leaders are trying to stagnate and get it still in the way it is, prevent this fertility, prevent this growth, prevent the possibilities for abundance and new ideas, because the old ideas are working just fine, thank you very much. And they use the media to preserve their power, to preserve old models, and to prevent new growth. Along comes some new interactive media that now allows some of this vibrancy to happen, and some of these new forms and some of these mutations. I mean, mutation is good on that level. And the object is not to limit mutation, but to get people more, to get people to love mutants more.
So you don't think that it's useful for there to be any bedrock, any solid foundation on which people can make their ideas?
I think there is, but I think people are going to have to, at some point, if we're going to move forward as a culture and survive, they're going to have to accept the fact that the bedrock that we're using is a social construction and not real. That the bedrock we're using is an agreement. That even ethics are an agreement. Thou shalt not kill is an agreement that this thing sucks. And right now, at the current level of civilization, it's really hard for people to accept that thou shalt not kill is an agreement, and they won't go for it unless they think there's a big scary God who's going to punish them in the afterlife for not doing it.
Yeah.
Apparently.
I would say that most people would take that, I mean, they maybe don't question why it's a thing or don't see it as being an agreement. Plenty of non-religious people don't believe that it's okay to kill people.
I know, I believe that. But there are many people who believe that a secular society cannot be successful. That without myths that people believe in, there will be no... that people will never internalize
and even
rules.
Like secularness, the secular society in itself is filled with myths too. Its own creation.
Right. I mean, I mean, this is what it's funny in all the MediaVirus talks with smart groups or you know it, wherever it used to turn into this. In the end, media. It comes down to whether you believe people are good or not. You know, that's sort of where it's where the question of persuasion will finally come down to also. If people are basically good, which is sort of this Rousseau Enlightenment idea, that people are born kind of wanting to be good and society and all this other stuff corrupts them, then you want this natural mutation, culture, chaos thing to happen because as people are free to be who they are, they'll be nice.
Isn't you equating Greek media viruses with nature the same as the church equating thou shalt not kill with it being like a law from God? Like, media viruses aren't natural. They're not part of nature.
Not part of nature?
Well,
in other words, bees make honey, people make media viruses.
Sure, but I mean, then you're going back to money. Is money a natural, inevitable thing, or is it something that people agreed on that we can work on and figure out why it happens and change, or decide not to use them? You know, whereas bees making honey isn't something that we can stop unless we kill
why
all the bees.
Why does media virus come down to money?
It doesn't come down to money. I'm just saying if money isn't an inevitable, natural thing that exists the way that it exists now and has to exist in that way because that's just the natural order, then the same, I don't think you can say the same thing for media viruses.
Right. I would say media viruses are an emergent phenomenon. In other words, that they are even though some have been made by people, I would argue that they did emerge naturally. I don't mean Mother Nature, but they emerged spontaneously because of the complexity of the media space that we humans built.
Sure, but I mean the same happened with money. Money
right.
emerged because of the...
And the emergent phenomena have emerged with money, and I would argue that a lot of the emergent phenomena are being repressed by people who want to hold on to money, and that if we actually allowed money to mutate the way money might want to now, like it did in Japan or it did in Ithaca and other places, rather than regulating it, that we might end up with something more interesting and more equitable.
Well, I think you can apply a bright line test between media virus and honeybees making honey, and that is...
What is it called? A bright...
Bright line. That is to say it either is or is not once you reach a certain, like, by this definition.
Okay.
So, like, in a vacuum. These scenarios exist in a vacuum, can either happen or it can't happen. And based on this one question, and that is media virus ethical? Is bees making honey ethical? Like, bees making honey has nothing to do with ethics.
Right.
Media virus, like, you have intent behind this idea. Because there's consciousness involved, you can't relate the two.
I think it's more like relating it to as a gun.
A gun has biases towards certain behaviors that you know a honey spoon doesn't. Now a media virus does have biases, even if it's a spontaneous virus, say like the Rodney King one. The bias of media viruses, and this is I think their danger, is towards sensationalism. Right.
That's kind of what I was trying to say.
Right, and as things become more sensational. Well, then what? I mean, on the one hand, I'd argue sensationalism is a good thing because we live in a deadened, numb society. So getting people to experience sensation through their media instead of what everyone complains about, desensitization through their media, is a good thing. If people get so much sensation that they don't know how to deal with it and end up having Rodney King riots, then that's a bad thing, right?
If it's truly organic, then I wouldn't need to worry about it because we're not catching viruses every hour. We're not, you know.
It's a new realm. The media realm is a relatively new realm that we're in, and we are still.
You're relating this to an organic environment.
I'm relating it more to culture. I'm looking at our culture and our society as an extension of our organic life, and I think that as culture gets more and more complex, and there's more and more feedback and iteration in culture, it becomes vulnerable, say, to many of the kinds of things that organic systems are vulnerable to. Now, when I first noticed media viruses as a phenomenon, I was inspired by them because I thought, here is finally a mechanism for infiltrating a media space that before the internet, mind you, this was really before the internet we know, this is before the web I wrote this thing, a media space that felt I was so locked out of, here is a phenomenon that now is allowing things to happen and allowing various cultural blockades to be broken down. As I look at it 10 years later, particularly in the wake of 2001, where we see the way remote high leverage points in a technological system can be used in dastardly ways, it gives me much more pause, and I'm much less gung-ho. What I believed at the time was if we can turn the media system turbulent and chaotic fast enough, it will become more like a natural thing and have more checks and balances in it that it doesn't have or it didn't have in the early 90s. But I'm looking at a society that seems rather unready to relate to itself in that way. So I'm less sanguine about the development of these bottom-up carriers.
Is it that the society is less ready to churn up the media space, or is it people reading books like yours in business hopping on the bandwagon? And is it kind of like people understanding the model and able to produce most of the media viruses in this dastardly way versus...
I don't think so. I think most... I honestly have a slightly Nietzschean, I guess, idea that media viruses only work if they're kind of supposed to work. In other words, media viruses won't really work unless they are targeting a true cultural confusion. But the problem is, targeting cultural confusion doesn't necessarily resolve that cultural confusion. All it necessarily does is inflame it, and inflame it again, and inflame it again, until we actually respond in an intelligent way. Did the OJ trial, did the Rodney King thing actually change any of America's interracial relations? I don't think they did. I think Madonna healed us sexually a lot more than Rodney King or OJ healed us racially, and that's saying a lot for Madonna. there's the fact that Like a Virgin would not work today is probably a good thing, right? Because I think when Madonna, in the mid-80s, when I was still alive, and Madonna came up, it was actually considered radical for this woman to be singing, ooh, Like a Virgin, ooh, and that's because we had a real problem with, we were just coming to grips with female orgasm back then. And clitoris and things like that were new. These were new ideas in America, I promise you. The Hype Report came out, and it talked about women having orgasms. People were like, oh my God, you mean I got to last 3 minutes instead of two? It was a big deal. Trust me. And in the beginning, guys like Larry Kramer, who were sort of early AIDS activists, were looking at, they were some of the first people to use media viruses intentionally, and they were saying, look, we've got a cultural immune deficiency to talking openly about AIDS, and what I'm going to do is provoke anger, provoke ACT UP. That's what it was about, was using media to provoke an immune response. In those cases, and done responsibly, it was actually good to get gay men out and angry, and we got to do something about this, and changing policy. But I agree that provocation after provocation after provocation can partly lead to this nightmare society.
But maybe the thing is, though, that when it is a cultural ferment, when it is a new thing that is being done spontaneously, it is something that has a lot of power. But once it becomes institutionalized and there are Seth Godin is telling us how we can make money out of it, it becomes this way of doing business, and you've got the internet that allows these things to go fast, and it becomes this idea that it's not like this thing that I'm doing because of AIDS and I'm using this method, or like you were saying, of like, these are things that we can do, when it becomes this thing of like, this is natural, this is the inevitable way that the current media space works, is that these things will fly around, and if you want to promote yourself and your work, you
right.
have to do it like this, and blah,
exactly.
blah, blah. Then it becomes, I think, something that's very stagnating and very
That's a key point. In other words, there's an ecology of media. I mean, I'm a media ecologist in the end. If you use an ecological model of media, and then you say, okay, there are these viruses happening, and that's really cool. But then if people start basically building virus factories that create a certain kind of virus to promote certain kinds of behavior and certain kinds of emotions, then you end up with an ecology that's kind of overrun by certain kinds of memes and not others. You know, and then my hope that culture will only react to viruses that it needs ends up being sort of overrun by this just mass production of almost by shotgun approach viruses that all have a bias, which is a bias towards making people feel powerless so that they buy something or believe in something.
But those don't, I mean, do those ever actually catch on as well? Probably, it seems like not.
Well, the Swift Boat virus caught on. Even though its memes were ultimately corrupt.
Or just the example of like Calvin Klein, you know, kind of tapping into America's insecurities about child pornography to sell more products, you know.
Right.
That's another example. I mean,
and then you have to look at though whether
issues.
Is our culture using the market to work out its problems, or is the market using the culture to sell its goods? You know, from the most optimistic standpoint, you could say, okay, here's this culture that needs all these adjustments. And all marketers are doing is going, okay, I'm going to help fix society in that way and sell some of my double mint gum in doing so. In other words, are the marketers really just, in a sense, cultural doctors?
So it's almost like it doesn't matter that they're making money. Is it good that we're bringing up the issue of child pornography? So
right.
Calvin Klein, okay,
you're
a rich guy, but
that'd be the happiest way of looking at it.
But then that's almost like looking at tobacco and saying, does it matter that, you know, the CEO of Philip Morris made $24.9 million, but he's killing it.
People need to find out that tobacco is really bad for them, and if the only way they're going to find out is with this many million people dying, then he's doing a good thing. Right, he's instructing
right.
us through.
Right.
But would it be better in 2005 for like culture to be immune to viruses, you know, rather than susceptible to them, if the possibility of them actually bringing about useful change is gone? And would it be more useful for activists to be, you know? And that's what I think eToy and people like that, at least in part, are doing now, rather than making their own viruses, is trying to show people how those kinds of viruses work so that maybe they can be immune to them rather than susceptible to them. Because they feel like if we're susceptible to an eToy virus, we're just as susceptible to a Philip Morris virus, and that leaves us very, very weak.
Well, then you get to the place, okay, there's sort of three stages in our relationship to media. There's my grandmother's, which looks to me completely passive, right? She's affected by viruses and la la la. Then there's the second stage, the educated person who's been educated by eToy or by Rushkoff or by someone to say, oh, this is a media virus, I see how it works, I can deconstruct it and maybe be less affected by it. And then there's a third stage, which is someone who can actually make media, which in theory is the bias of this program, which is saying, you know, we are either media artists or media activists, and that if we're living in a society, a true interactive society, then it's an authorship society through which we can make stuff. Does, you know, which, I mean, are you arguing in a sense that people kind of stop in that middle phase?
No, but what
it?
I'm saying is if we're educate, like, should, in the second phase and in the last phase, and I'm not entirely sure that, I don't think of either of my grandmothers are particularly affected by viruses, because I do think to a significant extent they move through media that they don't really, certainly my grannies don't have anything to do with. But my point is that if we're thinking about this, I think it's important that the bit about the people who are educated by Rushkoff and by eToy and by all these other people, that's a way of being immune, but also the people who are making it, the authors, are not making viruses for each other, you know, except, you know, because to me there's something very exploitative about it, and that it might be, and that's maybe what I'm proposing, and I'm not sure, but that like as, not only as consumers, of viruses, but as people who are making things, should we be launching our ideas virally? Which I've seen a lot of people from ITP try and use the viral thing to get their thesis idea into the media so that they can have their career outside. I'm like, is that a way that we should be, or are there better ways or more useful or more ethical or whatever forward-thinking ways for us to think about how to promote ourselves and get our ideas?
If a virus is unethical intrinsically, it's unethical because it's a Trojan horse, right? It represents itself as one thing, but there's little soldiers inside that are actually something else.
But that's not,
right?
I'm not saying that it's unethical intrinsically. I'm saying that maybe it's not an ethical decision to make given what viruses are now, and given the ways that they change the media space.
I mean, I would sort of disagree, because I would say like a lot of the more important historical figures in social movements started their movements by basically planting a virus. If you take somebody like, you know, Rosa Parks just passed away, there was just one action that was enough to like move a lot of people. Or you take Mahatma Gandhi, and he did the walk to the Salt Lakes in protest to the British government.
Or Thomas Paine and his pamphlets.
It's exactly. Very small action in order to, like, but the difference is that you're not trying to take advantage of the people. You're trying to mobilize people to make a change. Like he was saying, the problem with Rodney King is that you just generate angst and anger.
But if we're talking about sticky shells and memes, are those the, I mean...
Well, it sounds like
no,
the memes
they're totally, I mean, there's... In all those cases, there's the communication was the shell to move the information. They produced very potent memes, you know, very small memes that were picked up.
Well, these are people living in a world where the mainstream media that is capable of disseminating their ideas is unwilling to disseminate them because they have different values. So what you do, the whole purpose of a media virus... purpose, is it even tricky when they're spontaneous? The function of a media virus is to force, as I see it, to force the mainstream media or the media machine to spread an idea that it would normally be unwilling to spread because it can't help but spread the shell.
I'm skeptical about the whole thing. I'm still questioning whether someone can actually create a media virus. Intentionally.
What, I know.
People, I mean, you know, marketers and advertisers, if they could do that, that's all we have. And most of them fall flat on their face because, you know, it's dependent on where it's coming from, whether or not they're using the right medium for it, and whether or not the message is worthwhile. In your case, the message, the examples you gave, the messages were worthwhile, that it was, like, overwhelming. I don't think it really would have mattered whether, you know, Gandhi was handing out pamphlets, yelling out to people, or just, you know, whispering in people's ears. Just the message itself, the message itself, what he had was so valuable.
No, but I mean, I think in all those cases, the people that did those things were intelligent people in the sense that they actually picked a very specific action. Gandhi actually, throughout his career, picked very specific actions that people could get behind. So I think his...
Yeah. Well, here's one. The air pilots of KLM in the late 90s were... I wrote about this in Coercion, I think. They were going to go on strike. And as one of their tactics against KLM... what they wanted to do was circulate an email that listed their accounts as pilots of near misses that they had, because they thought it would be such bad publicity for KLM that KLM, you know, that just the threat of that. So KLM called me in as the media virus guy. What can we do to defend against this email that they're going to spread around? And I didn't tell them what they could do because I didn't want to get involved that way. What they could have done, though, would be disseminate a whole bunch of emails that have the same thing but aren't true, and then go on their website and say, look at these emails, this didn't happen, that didn't happen, this didn't happen, to then basically say, to show that these are, to basically, you know, populate it with fake ones, which is sort of like the killer bee strategy, when you put docile bees down there in Texas so that when the killer bees are coming up, you know, they mate with the wrong ones. But that was an example of, and that would have probably worked as a media virus for the air pilots for a while. You know, for what purpose? You know, well, for their strike, for a very different one. And just as really, a media virus is a weapon.
And also, just because something has a low success rate doesn't mean it can't be done. You know, real viruses have a low success rate too. It's their ability to mutate, and it's like the.
But it's
the
a lot easier to do the anthropology on cultural phenomenon that have occurred than it is to do the alchemy on creating a cultural... If people could create a fad, even just the fad of everybody talking about something. If you could create a Paris Hilton video, people would be doing it more.
I'm just saying that these instances in which you see advertising or marketing, you use viral, you know, marketing. I think a lot of it's coincidental, or it's in some cases it's somebody who's just really pushing an agenda in a particular agency because they want to do something that's more cutting edge. I don't think it's even, you know, they can make predictions, but I don't think, I just see it very difficult for, you know, if I was an advertiser or a marketer and I went to my client and said, you know what, we're going to do this and it's going to be a big, huge viral marketing thing and everybody's going to be talking about it, be on the, you know, 5 o'clock news, I'd be afraid to guarantee those types of results when there's, you know, there's nothing I can do that can basically say it's going to happen.
But your skepticism is about predictability. It's not about the model of a media buyer. So the fact that it can really influence people.
I guess, yeah, probably just the fact that we're trying to generate one's a little more difficult.
But there's no guarantee in any advertising. You just go with the people with the best track record.
Right, and it's not really advertising. I mean, a media virus, today is much more like, you know, a U2 iPod than it is some ad. I mean, it's generally some new, weird, recombinant media entity, not a commercial. It's really hard to do with a commercial. You know, those Absolute ads were sort of viral in their way. You know, because everyone, you know, different artists would make their own bottle.
And I see Rich's point, though, because, like you said, actually, a lot of marketers confuse, like, guerrilla marketing or
below the line and all these other things.
Viral marketing, and there's so much money being spent
on
marketers trying to create, you know, misunderstood versions of media viruses that are all really just stupid and not even inventive. So I hear what you're saying. Yeah.
No, I got the emails from the late 90s. Doers, Converse. God, I can't remember all the companies that emailed me. Will you come and create a virus? Heineken. Will you come and create a virus for our product? And I'm like, you don't want my virus for your product. You know, so Heineken, I went into them. I took $1,500 because they wanted to do a virus on truth. Right? That was what they were with their campaign. So I was like, okay, do this then. Say that every time you create a media campaign that says every time you open a Heineken, you've got to tell something to the person who's closest to you that you've never told anyone else before. You've got to tell them, in other words, tell them the truth about something that you've never told anybody. So let Heineken be every time Heineken is opened, the truth is told. And you know what I mean? Really? And they were like, oh my God, yeah, do that. Oh my God, no one's going to open a Heineken to the guy. There's all the truth. I said, all right, then you don't want to be about truth, do you? Goodbye. You know, give me my $1,500. But I mean, you know what I mean? But that was trying to turn Heineken into the virus itself. In other words, the truth virus. This is the thing, that opening Heinekens makes people truthful. Wouldn't that be cool? Rather than just getting drunk and telling the truth after the Heineken.
The military coin, you know what I'm talking about?
The what?
People go to the military, they have these coins, they can go to a bar, if there's someone else who was in the military, they can present your coin and they can get a free drink from them. And, you know, like there's an entire system of that, it's just kind of like,
right.
Well, that person has a coin, that they present it, you know, it's...
I mean, there's a lot of efforts, you know, remember the playing cards they came up with when they were trying to get bad people or something in Iraq or wherever?
Like the most wanted or whatever.
Most wanted playing cards?
Certain fake ones because the government didn't issue any.
Yeah, but it was a really weird media image because, you know, in Vietnam, was it, that they would take playing cards and put them on the dead Viet Cong? I mean, that's the cultural echo they were playing with those cards.
What
these
was
are
that
dead
about?
Men.
They would
in Vietnam, they had, like, your platoon or whatever had cards that were, like, identified with your
group.
So you were always the two of spades, and if you killed someone, you'd drop
something like that. I think that's more from a movie now than it was. I think it may have happened if it was in a movie, but, like, you know, the guy would always put, like, the hearts or whatever.
The king of hearts on a dead body? That's got to be Hollywood, dude. There's no way.
That's a mom. Like a mom.
It is?
Yeah.
It's like
a calling card, actually.
how they would leave the calling card so they would know, so the person who paid them would know who to pay.
But they were playing cards.
Playing cards or some kind of symbol that would make it into the media, like Walter Winchell kind of picture, like, you know, or a specific way of killing somebody, your tree.
Right.
I mean, the other possibility, and then we should break, the other possibility with media viruses is that they only really crop up when media itself is undergoing rapid mutation. You know, it's the early 90s, mid-90s, things were changing.